Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins at the Dragonfly in Bettendorf, using both conventional and alternative counseling methods for empowerment to help create change for individuals and couples. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
This is Ben Goujon with Quad City Arts, and welcome back to Talking Art, supported by Quad City Bank and Trust. Today, I am lucky enough to talk art with ceramic artist Jim Kronk and jeweler Ann Hartley, both of whom will be on display at the upcoming Riversance Festival of Fine Art. Ann and Jim, welcome to Talking Art. Great to have you both here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ben.
Yeah, we're excited about Riversance. It's coming up September 21st and 22nd over at Lindsay Park in Davenport. And both of you are going to be peddling your wares there. Tell us a little bit about those wares, Anne.
I am a jeweler. I work in sterling silver and high carat gold and some stones here and there. And I make modern, very unique jewelry. Most of my pieces are one of a kind. And I love it.
Yeah, and it is beautiful work. Jim?
Thank you.
Jim, I'm high fire pottery. I primarily do functional ware, plates, bowls, mugs, vases, flower pots, and such.
Yeah, and if you have not seen Jim or Ann's work around before, and their work has been around the area and at Riversance and lots of other festivals for a long time, they are both just really incredible artists, and it's really beautiful. How long have you been doing Riversance?
Oh, brother. How long have you been doing Riversance?
You know, I've been involved with Riversance since the mid-90s. So I kind of picked
me,
up.
For sure.
Well, I'm a little older than you.
Maybe.
And I did it off and on prior to that. So
I'm trying to think. I don't know. Let's see. We've been in the area for 21 years, but I didn't really start participating. So probably 10 years.
Got it.
I took a break. Like, it didn't happen during COVID, right? And then I took a break the year after that because I was sort of managing kids. But I've done it every other year for maybe 10, 11 years. It's been a while. I love that show.
Yeah, and if you've never been to Riverside.
Oh, it's so good.
It really is. It's out in Lindsay Park in the village of East Davenport. So you're on the bluff overlooking the river and the village, and it's just a great location. There are so many different artists there. I think this year there's going to be about 85 to 90 artists.
Yeah, it's super exciting.
Yeah, and it does focus. It is a juried art show, so the focus is fine art. So we really do try to get the best of the best there. Full disclosure, as someone who works at Quad City Arts as well as does this podcast, we try to select art that is you're not going to find at a typical maker's fair.
Yeah, I think generally speaking, it's all very unique. There's a really wide variety of artwork. And I think there's really something there for any price point and anybody's taste. There's modern things and there's more traditional pieces and there's functional and there's things that are more decorative. It's really a lovely collection of work.
Yeah. And I love what you said about price point because it is.
Absolutely.
There's stuff that if you've got $5,000 to drop on art, you can do that at Riversance.
If you have $5
to
drop. Please come see me.
If you have $5, you will find someone who's got something for you.
It's a really accessible art show. The music is great. The food vendors are fantastic. There's beer, right?
Yes.
There's a great addition from a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, there hasn't always been alcohol, but it's just really fun, and Lindsay Park is so beautiful.
Yeah, it really is a gorgeous way to kick off the fall. So, Jim and Ann, I'm so excited to see you at Riversance.
We're excited to
see your goods and hope we get lots of people to come out and buy those goods. Riversance will be September 21st and 22nd at Lindsay Park in the village of East Davenport. On Saturday the 21st, it's from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Sunday the 22nd. Admission is $5 a day, or you can buy a weekend pass for $8. And as Ann said, there's food, there's beer, there's wine, there's live music, there's children's activities.
And there's art.
And there's art, the most important thing, and the reason why we're there. All right. Well, let's dive in a little more.
I thought we were done.
No. This is just the beginning, Jim. We are diving in. So one thing that I love about, we talked about in that little bit, but the idea of functional art. You know, there mm-hmm. is art that is meant to hang on a wall. But yep. you both make art that is wearable in yeah. your case, Anne, usable yeah. in your case, yeah. Jim. And that's, I love that, just that idea of, in your case, Jim, elevating something that is a functional piece. Talk to me about that.
Each one's a little unique in you know, I hate making sets because I hate making the same thing over and over again. And so I try when I sit down, it's what do I feel like throwing today? And that's what I do. I've been at it a little while and I think I'm pretty good at it. And
how long have you been a ceramicist?
I did my first art fair in 74.
Yeah, so this is your 50th year of art fairs. That's awesome.
That's amazing.
I don't know if it's amazing or I never knew when to quit. You know, I got out of school in 70 and kind of played around for a while and got into the clay through the Davenport Art Gallery, had a program over there, and my wife made the mistake of saying, hey, you know, why don't you take one of those classes with Carl Christensen? And I got in it that was it. And I have been at it ever since. And someday I'm going to get it right, but I'm going to keep working at it.
That's what I love about art. And like, I find myself as an artist is there's that goal of quote unquote, air quote, perfection that we're never going to reach. No. But it's in the striving for that I find myself challenging as an artist. I don't know if that's how the two of you feel or.
Yeah, for sure. I think some of the best pieces that I've ever made started out as a mistake or something that I made and it didn't work or something was off about it. And then it sits on my bench for, I don't know, a year, 2 years. And then either my work evolves or my thinking about what a quote unquote mistake is evolves. And then it turns into, oh my gosh, this is what we're going to do with this. And it turns into the, you know, some of the best work I've ever made.
Sure.
Yeah. So I really, that's a big thing that I think about a lot is that mistakes are opportunities for growth. And, I don't know about in ceramics because I'm not a ceramic artist, but in jewelry, the only mistake that you can't really come back from is if you melt something into a puddle. And that luckily after 20, I mean, even then, honestly,
can't
like
you, just remelt have, it?
You can yeah. remelt it and you can make it into something else. But I think even there really isn't a lot that you can't come back from. And that is really energizing to me.
Well, and with clay, until it's been fired, you can always throw it back in the bucket and soak it down. And I recycle a lot of clay.
Try again.
Sure.
Yeah. I recycle a lot of silver and gold. Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's one of the fun parts is that you're never going to make something absolutely perfect.
Not yet, but we're working on it.
We're working on it.
We're working on it.
One of these days. Yeah.
Well, how did you, because I feel like clay and metalworking are such, not that they're outside the norm of art, but it's not something that's easy to, like, oh, I'm going to go get a piece of paper and draw a picture. Like, how did you respectively get into those fields, that medium?
Mine is tough. So I started out as a printmaker, and I did my undergraduate at Baylor University, and then I went and got almost a master's degree in printmaking at Illinois State. And my last semester, oh, my parents were so mad. The last semester, I wandered into the basement and found the jewelry department there and was so intrigued. And the professor there, who's not there anymore, Randy Reed, is still there. He gave me a book and he said, why don't you try to figure this out over the summer? So I read the book and I figured it out. And he said, well, why don't you make 3 or 4 pieces and I'll help you photograph them and then we'll see where this goes. So I did, and he helped me leave that program and start again at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana in their master's program for metalsmithing. And it was so great. Oh, I loved it so much. I love grad school so much. But I really feel like I'm glad that I started out as a printmaker, because I think my work still has that graphic element to it. It's sort of there's something that's sort of two-dimensional about it and very mark makery. And so I did carry that over, but I'm really glad that I had the wherewithal and the time to investigate. I mean, who has time to spend a whole summer sort of reading a book and figuring it out? Anybody? Nobody. Nobody does. So that was really a gift. And so thanks to Randy Reed, who's still at Illinois State. He's a great guy. So that's kind of, that's how that started. I don't know.
Yeah. What was your first clay?
Oh, I have all of these pieces that I've given away to family members that every once in a while I see them and I think, can I have that back? Can I replace that with something something new?
I know.
But for me, it's always been kind of a balance because I did once I got out of school, spent 40 years in manufacturing in the Quad Cities. I started at Case, then went to Cat, and then in the mid 80s when the ag industry kind of folded, I ended up over on the Arsenal, and I spent 28 years there. So I had 40 years in there, but all along I continued to play with clay, and it was kind of a therapy thing for me.
Sure.
And still is since I've retired, semi-retired. And has evolved. I did a lot of throwing for a long time, and then I started into building, and I do more. I kind of have an engineering background, and so I build a lot of boxes and kind of combine the throwing with the building. But most of my stuff now has square edges.
Sure.
And I still do a little throwing because everybody likes a round mug. And
we really do like a round mug. Thank you.
I know. I remember my sister dabbled in pottery. Hopefully she doesn't listen to this. But getting Christmas mugs that were like these odd-shaped mugs. And it's like, that's cute, but I'm never going to drink out of this.
Right. The handle really make or break a mug.
It's great pencil holders.
Yes.
Yeah, yes. That's right.
Yes.
That's right.
I have several of those from my daughter's foray into ceramics. Do you find that your engineering background helped you with clay bodies?
You know, I kind of work with the same. I make my own. I'm old school. I still mix my own clay.
That's good.
And
that's awesome.
That is
pretty much the recipe that Carl used. You know, he was my teacher and he was my mentor. He was my friend, and so I've kind of that same clay body. I've made some adjustments to it.
Sure.
But because it's just been a part-time, it's always been a part-time thing for me. And
yeah,
so,
me too.
You know, what works, and I kind of stay with that. I do some purchase with, I don't make porcelain, so if I want to do porcelain pieces, I will buy porcelain clay and some of that. But primarily, I'm a stoneware, and I still make my own clay. And
wow. That's a lot of work.
That is. Well, and I love you said the word visceral earlier, I think, or maybe I thought it, but like there is something about throwing clay and working with clay that is, it's metalwork,
therapeutic.
I assume. Yeah, like you are there shaping materials and kind of, I would assume sometimes, like a, and I know you're a teacher, Anne, like a child doesn't always do what you want it to do.
How do you deal with that? So frustrating. Metal usually does kind of what I want it to do. I don't have that. I can't imagine. I took a ceramics class once, and it was so hard and so, and I wanted so badly to be so good at it, and I was so bad at it. And I have such great respect for potters. I just, it is so hard. Oh.
Practice.
I guess. Yes.
Yeah.
It's something that you have to work at. And for some, it comes easier than others, I guess. But
we had a family friend who was a potter growing up, and I would sometimes go out with my grandparents to their house and throw with him. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I hadn't done it in 20 years and was like, oh, I'm going to take a class. I've done this before. I know how to do this. Mm-hmm. flop, wobble, wobble, wobble. Mm-hmm. Later, I was like, oh my gosh, this is a lot harder than I remember. Yeah.
I know. People look at my work and they're like, how did you make that? I'm like, it's not, you bend the metal and the soldering part is tricky, but metal kind of does what I want it to do because I know how to work it and I've been doing this for like 25 years, but it seems easier than making clay do what you want clay to do. Yeah.
Well, and clay's just got a strength to it. Like when you're working with it, like it pushes against you, I find.
Well, the beauty with clay is when throwing for the most part, if it doesn't feel right, you just cut it off. Throw it, and you grab another bottle of clay, and you start over again.
That's so nice.
And that's what you got to learn is not every pot is going to be a keeper, that's just part of it. And you throw with something in mind, and sometimes that changes because the clay has kind of its own mind too. You're just trying to control what it wants to do, and so sometimes cooperates with you and sometimes it doesn't, and then you just cut it off the wheel and we'll start with another mound of clay and go from there.
So nice.
Well, it makes me think of, like, I've heard sculptors or read about sculptors in interviews talking about, like, no, you're just revealing what that piece of stone or wood wants to be, and that, you know, that made me think of that, Jim, that mound of clay, like, you're trying to make me into a bowl. I don't feel like being a bowl.
I have something in mind when I start, and sometimes the clay disagrees with what I have in mind. So. I'll just cut it off, and it's a new mound of clay again.
So. My raw materials are, I guess I don't know how much clay costs, but my raw materials are pricey, and so I think sometimes that's motivating to me to not pitch it in the scrap pile, because I mean I do have a scrap pile and I do send that off and get it refined and then send it back, but it's like, oh, I can't get, especially if I'm working with 18 karat gold, because I know it's this tiny little thing is hundreds of dollars and I can't goof it up and I don't want to throw it in the scrap pile. And so the thought of just sort of throwing it back in a bucket, that sounds good. Oh, I'm going to think of that the next time I goof something up in my studio.
Well, when you start on pieces, like, where do you guys find your inspiration from you've both been doing this for a long time now. Like, what do you do to keep fresh? And
I think I used to think that I got inspiration from nature, and I think that's still kind of true. I love the line about how there's no straight lines in nature, and I find myself looking for straight lines, and most of my pieces involve circles that are a little wonky or lines that aren't quite straight. I find myself looking at textile design and really any, like, furniture design. I think I look at other artists. I don't look at other jewelry artists. I find that frustrating. And there was a time where I was really in a slump, kind of around the time of COVID, maybe a little before, and then COVID didn't help, where I was too much of a sponge and I couldn't look at other artists' work, other jewelry artists, because I felt like I was too empty of ideas and that I was too much of a dry sponge, and that if I looked at anything that I was going to start making other people's work and not my own.
Sure.
And so I really looked to modern textile design and modern furniture design and modern architecture. And I, and even photography, modern photography, I was looking at that quite a bit. And then I went back and I looked at my old prints, which was really crazy. And some of them were sort of helpful. Some of them were terrible. Like, it was good.
Yeah.
It's good that I'm not a printmaker anymore, even though I keep thinking I should make prints. And then I think you weren't very good at that. But I...
That's never stopped me.
I just ordered a printing press, so it's not going to stop me either. But because I find it making... I still love the idea of making prints. And I, anybody who is good at that, like, please keep doing it. Please don't let printmaking die. But I really looked outside of jewelry, and I think I looked outside of typical, like, capital F fine art stuff, because I just felt too... I needed to look at other sources. And you, Jim?
Thanks, Anne.
I look at other people's work and not to steal, but just to see what others are doing and just kind of get a feeling. You know, I kind of like those lines and how they, and then I look at others' works in the magazines and
sure.
whatever. And,
I can do that now. I find myself doing that now, that I'm much more comfortable with what I'm making and I don't feel so in a slump. That was a rough 4 years. But now that I'm really comfortable, I can look at other jewelers' techniques and go, oh, tab setting a stone, that looks fun. And then mm-hmm. how can I incorporate that into my work? And sometimes it works and sometimes... not so much.
Well, and one thing I love about both of your work is you have a very distinctive personal look to what
you
do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even though you have varied work, like I can mm-hmm. look at a bracelet and say, oh, that's an Anne, or,
aww.
You know, look at something of yours, Jim.
Isn't
and say,
that really the highest compliment you can give an artist?
And I think
voice.
It's, yeah. Yeah, you do. You have found
see somebody's
voices.
Work and say recognize it as, you know, that's one of Anne's pieces or
yeah.
one of Jim's pieces. Yeah. I think that's the thing that we all want to have. And it takes for artists out there, it takes a really long, wouldn't you say? It
yes.
just takes forever. And you're trialing and erroring and mm-hmm. then you'll go to a show and you'll look at your work laid out. It's like five different people did it. And you're just, it's just you're in the desert wandering for so long. And then, I don't know, and then it just sort of happens that you stumble across something that feels really good and then you just keep making it or variations of it.
Or something that sells anything.
I can't do that. Every time, oh, man, every time I sit down at my bench and I think, I'm going to make this thing so that it sells at a show. Mm-hmm. I still have a whole bag full of all that stuff mm-hmm. that I want to melt down. Mm-hmm. But I think, no, this was a lesson. This is a lesson to you. And it never really looked like my work. It always looked like I was making something to sell.
Sure.
And so it just felt it was disingenuous in my experience. Like, I can't do that.
But I get people that come by and say, do you make something or I saw somebody make something like that and can you do it? And then a lot of times it's like, well, if you're not in a hurry, my orders are usually about a 6 month out thing
yeah.
because number
right.
one, I don't like to take orders. So, so when I do, I always preface that with, yes, I can do that. I'll give it a try. And if you don't hear from me in 6 months, give me a call and remind me. But
well, how do you – I mean, I know you both do fairs. You do it part-time. Mm-hmm. Do you also do a lot of custom work or – you know, because I always feel
– we're both making a face. You can't see us. We're both making a face.
Well, I always feel talking with artists, there's a sense of like, I know, like, I just want to make what I want to make. and then people will like that versus the financial reality sometimes of.
I think I'm really lucky that I have a group of people who come to me and say, I'm trying not to be super specific because I just had a meeting with a client this week, but like who say, I have this stone. Here you go. Well, when you're ready, we'll talk about it. And then they allow me time to percolate and make sketches and forget about it for a minute and then remember back and kind of come back with fresh thoughts and fresh eyes. But I do get, because I do sell on Etsy, I do get the number one, if you ask any jeweler, the number one question they get is how much would this be in gold every time? And it's always a thousand times more than you think it's going to be. But I get a lot of that. And sure. So I spend a lot of time mathing what it would be in gold. But I do get a lot of requests for, my least favorite is, they send me a picture of another artist. I'm sure you get this all the time. Another artist's work. And then they say, how much would it cost for you to make this? And you know that they're fishing for a cheaper price.
Right.
And so a lot of times I will decline that, or I'll find the artist and let them know that people are, because it's not like, you guys think we don't all know each other. We all know each other. And so, that is something I do not appreciate. But when somebody comes to me and says, I have a stone or a hype, even I have an idea for a pendant or a bracelet, and I love to hear them out. Some of the really great things that I have made have been for clients who came to me with an idea, and we met each other in the middle. And that's really gratifying to collaborate with a client on something like that.
Well, for me, because pottery has not been my primary source of income.
Sure.
I make what I want to make when I want to make it.
That's so nice.
it's therapy for me.
Sure. And, I have a background, though, as a bench jeweler. So I worked for 5 years. 5 years, shout out Diamond Cellar in Columbus, Ohio. They hired me with no experience. My bench test was an absolute disaster. Like, I melted the whole thing. And I think they only hired me because I laughed during the whole thing, because it was so ridiculous. Like, there was no way I was going to be able to do this, because I was persistent and I had a good attitude about it.
Sure.
And I learned so much there, and I enjoyed, that was someplace where you're not making your own work. You are, somebody comes to you and says, I want a puzzle ring with cherubs and bows and 5 marquee diamonds. You have to be like, okay, we'll get that done for you. And it has nothing to do with what I wanted to make almost ever. And so I think I got very good at working with clients, and I find myself a lot of times, sometimes not, but many times being sort of energized by that connection with bringing something to life that somebody has in their head, because I feel like we're both really lucky that we can do that, like have a movie of a thing in our head that we want to make, and to be able to sit down and make it. That's a gift.
Yeah. What exactly is a bench jeweler? I had never heard that term before.
Okay. So a bench, for those, I guess we're all bench jewelers, but I worked as a bench jeweler at a really big jewelry store. So it isn't very common anymore. Most jewelry stores will send their repair work or their custom work out to a job shop. And is sort of, I've never seen one, but I'm assuming that it's a dark basement someplace where there's a lot of goldsmiths who are drinking a ton of coffee and muttering to themselves. So that may not be true, but that's what I imagine. But the place where I worked, the Diamond Cellar, they have two locations in Columbus. And there were probably, when I started, we were in the basement, but it wasn't dark. There were probably 20 goldsmiths, which is really on site. And they were some of the most talented. It's like breathtakingly talented.
Sure.
And I learned so incredibly much about how to treat a customer, how to work with customers, how to work within a budget, how to ask people what their budget is, because I think a lot of artists really struggle with that, to ask, okay, you want an engagement ring, how much do you want to spend? It's an uncomfortable conversation, but it's one that you can't proceed without. And so I learned not just about like wax carving and stone setting and all that kind of stuff, but like the nuts and bolts of running a business there. So a bench jeweler really is somebody, to answer your question, sorry, is somebody who works at a jewelry store, who works predominantly on fine jewelry. I think of myself more of a metalsmith now, because I'm not really making like jewelry store jewelry, but a bench jeweler or a goldsmith is somebody who works at a jewelry store who makes conventional jewelry that you would find at a jewelry store. So there are a couple of places here in town that do have goldsmiths, but most places, I think it just is too expensive and they send stuff out to a job shop, which can be fine. I'm not slamming a job shop.
No, someone's got to do it.
Somebody's got to do it. And I think that having somebody on staff, though, is so nice, because the salespeople don't really know. Like, sometimes they don't know. Like, can this be repaired? Is this truly broken? Can we carve this wax? Or how are we going to fix this? And if there's not a goldsmith there or a bench jeweler on staff, then they are sending it out to somebody that they don't know. So it's always better to have somebody on staff, I think.
Yeah.
But that was an awesome job. That was an incredible job.
What a great kind of first experience.
Oh my gosh. I spent the first
side of it
couple months polishing. And then they let me set earrings, the tiniest. Oh God, they were so small. The tiniest earrings. And I spent my lunch breaks in the bathroom in the third stall just crying, because I was like, I can't do this. And I figured it out. I mean, it was very hard, because they don't teach you that in grad school, how to set teeny tiny diamonds and teeny tiny little prongs. It was
sure.
But it was really, I stuck it out and I worked there for about 5 years, and then we moved here. Well, it was a great experience.
It reminds me of, did either of you ever see that documentary, Euro Dreams of Sushi?
Oh, I've heard of it. I have not seen it.
Yeah,
he's the sushi master.
He's the sushi master in Japan. And like, they're talking about the people that work under him. And it's like, yep, for the first 10 years, you prepare the rice.
No, seriously.
And that's all you do. And once you've learned, you've mastered the rice preparation after 10 years, then maybe we'll let you look at some fish.
This was sort of like the European apprentice system. So in Europe, they actually have an apprenticeship system for goldsmiths. Like, you can be, like, my husband is a plumber and he went through his apprenticeship system and now he's a journeyman plumber. And it's very similar in England, where you can go through this whole system where you start as a polisher and you then you set tiny dot, you know, it just moves its way up. I think I didn't get all the way there because I think I talked too much in the basement. And I drove them nuts. If Joan Wooten is listening, she'll probably affirm that. But and they were like, let's just stick her upstairs and make her work with customers. And that ended up working out well. So I worked upstairs with the five. They were called designer goldsmiths. And they were all wildly more talented than I was. But I was good. But I was good at working with customers. And so it balanced out. I learned so much from them. Oh, my gosh. They really pushed me. If I designed something, they made me make it. It was rough, but I did a good job and I never gave up, and I broke some stuff. It wasn't great. Sometimes there were days where it was hard, but I'm glad I did it.
Well, I'm sure that experience with customers, like, I know you guys have both been active in the art fair scene. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what that's all about. Tell me a little bit about that side of working the art fair circuit.
Working the circuit.
Yeah.
Well, it started out, we didn't have tents. Nobody used tents when I started. You sat in the sun, or you had an umbrella, or you got rained on.
Sure.
Which wasn't bad for a potter, because you just dump the water out and keep on going. But
right.
nobody had tents to begin with.
Oh, my gosh.
We were pioneers. I mean,
you were.
Man, but dealing with people, it's kind of funny. They'll come along and they'll look at it, they'll turn around and set it down, walk away. And you think, you know, I bet that person comes back. And a lot, it's kind of fun just watching the people.
Oh, the people watching is the best.
Yeah, I did shows in Iowa City and Ames, and the college towns are fun.
Oh, they are. Because you get the students. Watching is amazing.
Especially if you get someone that you can tell they're probably a ceramic student because they're looking and they're.
Yes.
And finally they'll come up and they'll start asking you questions. And that's fun to talk to them.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed doing that.
I never mind that either. I think, and hey, just FYI, if you come to a craft show and you can't afford the thing that you're looking at, it's okay for you to still look at it. Like I can't afford some of my own work. Like, I don't, like, it's really okay. We totally understand. We just would appreciate a compliment, and then you can keep going. You don't, like, have to say how expensive it is or how you can't afford it. Yeah. It's totally fine. Like, it's totally fine. Like, there's a script that a lot of people, I think, read off of when they come to craft shows because they don't know what to say. We're just human beings.
And I don't know how jewelers, but as a potter, a lot of times we'll get, is this your price? I mean,
please don't do that.
And
I don't get that a ton.
I don't think so, but we do.
As potters?
Yeah.
Don't do that to the potters.
And I always say, I think my stuff is reasonably priced and
this is
what it is.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And if you find something you like cheaper and better, go for it.
That takes a long time to get there. I think also is with the pricing is really tricky. But it's just been in the last maybe 5 years that I have come up. I have a spreadsheet and it works great. Like it is so hard to price because it's so hard to price things that are to make things that I really couldn't afford myself. That's the other thing I learned working at a high-end jewelry store is that I had my boss pull me aside one time and said, you have to get more comfortable pulling things out of the case that are hundreds of thousands of dollars. You have to stop making that face or saying, oh, this costs more than my house. Like you can't do that anymore. And so I often counsel new or sort of emerging artists to stop pricing with their own pocketbook because that's really, you're going to underprice yourself every time.
Yeah.
You have to price your pieces what they're worth. Yeah. Otherwise your business won't survive. I mean, you just can't survive unless you're making a profit.
Yeah.
So.
You have to make a profit?
You do. Some people do.
And that's so hard too. Like, you know, obviously you have your material costs that factor in, like the time you spent on it. But then there's also the creative time that is needed that may not, like, how do you calculate that?
Well, it's not just that. It's like you and I'm assuming both use gas, right?
You
have a gas kiln. I have a gas torch. We have lights in our studio.
Yes.
We have
fixed costs, as they say.
You
know, there's all these costs of running a studio that you have to roll into your overhead, that you have to roll into the price of this work. And it's not just the time. I mean, a lot of times I will charge for the just the time that I'm sitting at the bench, but I have an hourly rate that I think that is fair, that sort of assumes that I spent some time sketching in front of the TV, although I'm not a big sketcher, or muddling around with an idea before I, because when I have an idea, I don't sketch a whole lot. I will sort of get started and then muddle around with it until it tells me what it wants to be. I mean, I think that's very, what Jim said is sort of accurate. And that time I kind of don't count, but I pay myself an hourly rate that assumes that I can do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's people don't understand. They think that this stuff just hatches out of eggs and it's not true.
People will pick up a mug and they'll say, well, how long did it take you to make that?
Oh, I get that a lot.
And I say, well, let's see.
That's exactly the right answer.
I threw the mug, maybe 5 minutes. I threw the mug, but I made the clay. You know, and I mixed the glazes, and I had to trim the mug, and then I had to pull the handle and apply the handle.
Yeah, the least amount. I know that's.
But I can throw a mug in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
But
watch
it's all those
pottery
other things
video. That, it is so labor intensive. So yeah. labor intensive. Yeah.
Yeah, that's one of my wrists are shot. My shoulders are shot. I've been doing this for 50 years. You know, it's
a lot.
I remember my my old car place had something that was like, the reason we can do this in 30 minutes is because we spent 30 years studying it.
Yes.
And that's why our fees are what they are.
Yeah. Yes. No, I think that's really true.
You're paying for the 30 years.
Yes.
So that I could do it in 30 minutes.
This mug that I throw in five
minutes.
That's
true.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's very accurate. And, I also think there's an element of a good potter and a good jeweler that things that is lacking in amateur, like new potters and new, somebody who makes something that is meant to be held or touched, is that it took me a long time to make things that felt good on the body or felt good in your hand. And there, I have so many mugs that feel crummy or bowls that feel crummy in my hand. They're bottom heavy or they only hold a dribble. Who makes mugs that only hold a dribble of coffee? It's so weird.
But
it's
like, tankard.
I want a pot of coffee in this thing. But like making a good handle is a skill. You guys have no idea how hard it is to make a good handle.
I know.
It is. You know. But it is, it's tricky. And to make things that hang correctly or don't pinch or don't itch or don't squeeze in the wrong spot or they're not too tight or too loose. I mean, that takes years and years of trial and error of getting it wrong, making a piece that doesn't hang particularly nicely. And then you have to either chop it up and make it into something else or it goes in the scrap bin.
Yeah. And that's the thing with mugs. Every time I see somebody that's going through the mugs, because I try to get a variety of them, but I'll say, first, you got to find one that feels right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it can't just be with a look. You've got to pick it up, hold it, because, you know, that's kind of a personal thing.
It's the
if it's
going to
be your favorite mug,
and
it's going to be your favorite mug.
Yeah.
And that's kind of nice because there's certain shows I do over and over, and people come by, and I've got one of your mugs. I use it every morning. I love it. And,
oh, isn't that the best?
That's a nice thing to hear.
Yeah.
I love that.
But then
that's
I bought one of your bowls once and then they walk away, you know, and that's a problem with doing
the
same shows and local shows. Davenport, you know, I've done since 74, I've done a lot of Davenport shows.
Before tents, people, imagine that.
So it's like I had to branch out.
I'm going to have a nightmare about that tonight, doing a show without a tent. Never going to stop thinking about that.
But it's never been a full-time thing for us.
Sure.
And early on we did a lot. I'm down to like four shows is all I do now.
Yeah, I do three.
Because I'm kind of on the downhill slope.
Jim and I were just talking about that before we started that I should be on the downhill slope too, but I have some bucket list shows that I would like to do. So I'm not dead yet, but we'll see.
I have a potter friend that just retired here last year, and it's like, Bill. You know, he's a year older than me or two. So I think, I got two more years to go anyway here. So
that's hilarious.
So hear that. You only have a couple years left
to get Jim's work.
So come to Riversons. little commercial. But honestly, guys, this has been so great. Like, I feel
thank you.
We could sit here and talk for another hour.
Yeah.
But we're so excited and blessed to have you at Riversons this year. And
super excited.
We're excited to be there.
I'm really, I love this show. It's my favorite show.
Well, having been on the committee for several years, it's a great organization. They put together a great show. We got a great team we work with. And
it's wonderful.
And
we're
proud of what we put out there.
Yeah.
And
yep. So if you have never been to Riversons, come on out September 21st and 22nd at Lindsay Park in the Village of East Davenport. 10 to 5 on Saturday, 10 to 4 on Sunday. Live music, great food, beer, wine, kids' activities, and of course, Jim and Ann and all of our other incredible artists. Jim and Ann, thank you once again for being my guests today on Talking Art.
Thank you so much.
Yeah,
thanks,
absolutely.
Ben.
Thanks, Ben.
We want to thank Quad City Bank and Trust again for supporting Talking Art. talking art. Talking art. Talking art. For more information on Anne's work, you can go to annhotleystudio.com. And for more on Riversongs, go to quadcityarts.com. Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ben.
Cheerio.
This has been Talking Art.